Okay, it's 9:00. My clock, it says 9:01, so we should start, although I still see people coming on, but let's begin. I just want to call your attention to a few things before we pick up again with Rav Zevin. This book just came out, and I picked it up. You can see it, Or Sameach Halacha Mishpat. The English title is The Or Sameach Halacha and Jewish Law, Rav Meir Simcha Cohen's Writings on Maimonides' Code. It's a long book. 385 pages on in Hebrew, which comes to probably about 450 in English. I would have thought that the first book, well, there was a book by Yonah ben Sasson on the Meshech Chachma, on the philosophy, but I would have thought we would get another book on the Meshech Chachma. Instead, we have an entire book on the Rav Meir Simcha and the Mishneh Torah. So although we finished Rav Meir Simcha a few classes ago, I'll start going through this book and I'll report on stuff I see. And you can include that as part of our Rav Meir Simcha talks. In fact, let me just call your attention to one thing I saw over the summer. I was learning more of the Meshech Chachma, various parshios, and something very interesting in Korach. We discussed before, I discussed in my book, The Limits of Orthodox Theology, this dispute about kfira b'shogeg, unintentional heresy, that you think that you really believe something that's heretical. Are you regarded as a heretic? It goes back, I guess, to the Rambam and the Raivad, or apparently to the Rambam and the Raivad. And there's debates all throughout the ages. If you look, the Meshech Chachma says something very interesting in Korach, in chapter 16, Pasuk Lamed. He calls attention to the Pasuk there that says, Pasuk Lamed, Perek Tet Zayin, Pasuk Lamed, if the Lord makes a new thing, and the ground open her mouth and swallow them up with all that appertain to them, and they go down alive into the pit, then you'll understand that these men have despised the Lord. He's talking about Korach and his minions, that this is the sign that they have been evil if they're swallowed up. So the Meshech Chachma wants to know, why doesn't just say that, if the pit opens up, the pit's going to open up and it's going to swallow them. Why does it have to have this business about kiniyatsu hanashim elat Hashem? What is that you'll know that they despise God? They had opposed Korach. I mean, they had opposed Moshe. So that's enough of a reason for them to be swallowed up. The Meshech Chachma says, however, first of all, he says that if they had a doubt, if they had a doubt that what Moshe said was true, then their sin would not have been so great. Their chet would not have been so great. Because it wouldn't have been their fault. If they really believed that everything they said, that Moshe has taken everything for himself, etc., etc., there wouldn't have been a problem, really, with them. It wouldn't have been so terrible. They would have made a mistake, but they wouldn't have been deserving what they were given. However, Meshech Chachma explains, since they had no doubt, and they were only doing this, even though they knew the truth, as an act of rebellion, therefore, the Pasuk points out that you will know that that these people despised Hashem, v'rak b'mered, b'li safek. This really fits in very well to the idea that when people make a mistake, it could be a basic theological mistake. What could be more basic than denying, Moses' prophecies and thinking that he's a fraud? That's the basis of everything we believe, that not believing he's a fraud, that he's authentic. And yet the Meshech Chachma says that if Korach and the rest had really believed this, it wouldn't have been so bad. They wouldn't have been doing such a bad thing. It's precisely that they knew the truth and they rebelled against it. So I think you'd have to put the Meshech Chachma on the side of those who really exonerate people who even make basic theological errors because of what they think to be the truth. One more point before we pick up where we left off last week. There's a lot to say about Rav Zevin. Already last semester, I spoke about this book, Olamo Shel Abba. This is the book by this Hungarian rabbi, Rabbi Asher Anshel Miller. This is an ori. I told you the whole story last semester, and I said that I never thought that they would reprint this book because years went by and you couldn't find it. I paid a lot of money. I found it on eBay. It was published in 1984, and lo and behold, last year someone reprints the book. And I gave you some examples, but people asked me for some more examples. So let me just give you quickly, just tell you a story here, and then tell you. Well, let me start with something he says, which I'm going to put on my next Sfarim blog post. It was delayed a bit because the book sent to me from Interlibrary Loan was the wrong one, but maybe this week. Let me tell you what he says in here, which he's in my post, I quote a few things he says, a couple things, but first, this is, I think, unbelievable. But then I'll tell you a story he tells, which is another reason why it couldn't be in. First, what I'm going to tell you now is the sort of thing I think is designed for rabbis telling other rabbis. I have this whole theory. I mentioned it before. I think even last week I might have mentioned it, that I believe that the Talmud itself is a document designed for rabbis, for other rabbis. They never occurred to them that the masses would be studying it because certain things said, criticisms and rebuke and really insulting comments about other rabbinic figures, I can't imagine they'd want the masses to know this. The same thing can be said in Rishonim. So the way that they criticize other Rishonim, they can never use this language if they were speaking to the masses, I think for the most part. I think you can say this about what I'm going to tell you now. He says as follows, that, and you'll see another example in my post. If you recall at a wedding, we request of the bride and groom that they should be joyous, like in Gan Eden Mikedem, like Adam and Eve in Gan Eden. So he asks, and this is the sort of thing that I can't imagine ever being translated, if anyone decides to translate this book into English. He asks, what do you mean? Why would we possibly tell a bride and groom to rejoice like in Gan Eden? What's so special about Gan Eden? You could say rejoice like Abraham and Sarah, but what is Gan Eden? What does Adam and Eve have anything to do with anything? And he said as follows, that we do not have like drushas today at our weddings, but apparently in Hungary, in the early part of the century, the rabbis really speak. He says that you have these weddings, and the rabbi speaks. We keep our rabbis, we give them maybe 2 minutes, and then no more talking, he says, and they would speak. So he says, here you have a chasna and kava, trying to rejoice. And what happens? The rabbi comes along, and instead of just leaving them alone and letting them enjoy themselves, what does he have to do? He has to get up and give a talk and speak to them and give mussar and tell they have to build a bais, neman bais shor, and all these things they have to do and destroy the whole simcha. So therefore, he says, that's why we wish them that they should enjoy the simcha like in Gan Eden and Adam and Eve, because there weren't any rabbis in Gan Eden coming to ruin the party. Now, I know he's saying this tongue-in-cheek, but the fact he can say this, like I said, I find this quite incredible. But and on page 505 and 506, he talks about the Hasidim in his city. The bunch of ignoramuses they were and how much trouble they caused him. And let me just summarize to you what he says. And this is the, for those who wanted to know why for so long this book wasn't reprinted, and it was under like a mini ban, because it tells it like it is. He starts saying that that the Hasidim in his village, he lived in a small village, they were not like Hasidim in central Hungary. They were observant on Torah and they followed mitzvos and everything, but they were ignoramuses, burim v'rikim, and he says it was difficult for me as the rabbi to have anything to do with them and to lower myself to their level. He said it was always difficult for me to have to sit with these simple, ignorant, without uncouth people, because I had nothing to learn from them, and even their basic talk, the way they expressed themselves, caused me pain. So here we see an honest statement from the rabbi of a town, which unfortunately for him had Hasidim. But then it gets worse. He mentions that in Pressburg, where he learned, they didn't daven long. Davening was not supposed to be long. They saw this as Bittul Torah. And, even on Yom Kippur, he says, the Chasam Sofer used to speak words of Torah. They did not have such long davening. And therefore, he said, it was bishvili, for me, very difficult, almost impossible to take, when I had to participate in the tefillahs on Shabbos. What happened was, he says that various admorim, Hasidic rebbes, would come to this town, and he would have to spend Shabbos with them and participate in davening with them. And he says it was very difficult because the davening would go on and on and on. And then he said, I have to do something kasheh beyoter, even more difficult. I have to sit at the table, at the tish, with the Rebbe, on the Leil Shabbos Kodesh, and also twice on Shabbos. So this is for the first meal and the second meal on Shabbos day. And every meal would go on for hours, 4 and 5 hours, and I have to listen to the songs and the Zmiros together, and banging on the table and dancing without any Divrei Torah. And that's in a different to the pushing. Everyone, when they come to grab the Shiraim, I have to sit through this. Remember, he's a Hungarian Rav, but not a Hasidic Rav. And at the end of the meal, the Hasidim would, as soon as the meal was brought out, as after the singing and everything, when they brought the meal out, the Hasidim would turn into, as he calls them, animals. And they would jump on the food. And then he goes on. Nevertheless, he says, when a rabbi was here, I had to go sit with them, because what was I going to do? And then he says, the Hasidim, they'd come to speak to me, and I try to teach them Torah, and it wouldn't satisfy them, because they were not interested in that. They wanted to hear words like the Rebbe would give them, and et cetera, et cetera. He continues. And so that's an example of what I mean, the truth. It's interesting, on that very page, he tells about another practice of the Hasidim, which he doesn't know what to make of it. He says that when someone would have a daughter, and they'd be brought up to do a Misha Beirach, they would start banging and everything, and they'd grab the person and wrap him in his talus and hit him and make a big, like, simcha out of it, except for the guy being hit. And he thinks this is just a crazy practice. He doesn't know anything about it. He thinks, actually, it goes back to the time of Chazal, when it was a good thing to have a daughter, but now, I mean, it goes back to the Second Temple. Mitzrayim, he says. It goes back to Mitzrayim, when Paro decreed against the men, so if you had a daughter, you rejoiced. But he says, Chazal already tell us, Oilo l'misha b'adam l'keva, but in our day and age, it's very difficult to raise daughters, so it's not such a good thing. I think he has it just opposite. If anyone read Solomon Maimon's autobiography, Solomon Maimon describes going to one of the Hasidic Rebbe's, and he describes he was there on Shabbos, and a man had a daughter, and everyone was like doing the same thing to him, and Solomon Maimon sees this as an example of lowly people who don't treat the female's sex properly, that they think this is a bad thing. I think it's just the opposite. I think it's precisely because of Oilo, and woe to one who has daughters, that this is why the Hasidim are reacting this way. And the thing he records in early 20th century Hungary is recorded by Solomon Maimon in his autobiography. I know nothing about today whether any Hasidim have this sort of thing. You should know, incidentally, and this is the last point I'll make before we pick up with Rav Zevin, that this Asher Amshel Miller also wrote a volume of Tshuvot called Chaye Asher. He wrote other Sfarim as well. In his volume of Tshuvot Chaye Asher, he has a responsum about the case of Chich. It's actually the only rabbinic responsum dealing with Chich. Chich was a town in Hungary. In Chich, a girl got pregnant. A teenager. And, what do you do when a girl gets pregnant like this and you don't want to get in trouble? Well, it used to be 2,000 years ago, you could say that God impregnated me, but that line has already been taken. So, I assume in the case 2,000 years ago, it was the father who came up with this. But you couldn't use that line. What happened in Chich in the 19th century was that they claimed she was impregnated by a demon. And this becomes a huge cause célèbre that continues to this day. There are certain families, I even know someone who's in this family, there are certain families who are known to be descendants of the demon. There's an idea of the succubus and incubus. And there are families in Satmar to this day who will not intermarry with other Satmar families because they are descended from the demon. And there's even an entire article on this by a woman named Hannah Sprecher. I can send anyone the article. Here's a copy of it. The Satmar Rav himself came out publicly and defended all pictures and said there's no parah. Many Satmar did not agree, and there's a Sefer Yuchsin. It's everyone in Satmar knows Chich, and they know which family you want to keep away from. This is the first time like this has happened, as far as I know, since the Nadler case, the Maharal. In the days of the Maharal, all the Nadler families had to keep away from them, but it wasn't because of a demon that impregnated them, it was because just they had yichus problems. No, it's not Chust. Chust is a big rabbinic city. Chust is an important city. I even think the Maram Shik was rubbing Chust for a while. No, this is, in English we write it as Chutka. Chotca. It's, in northeastern Slovakia. But it is definitely not Chust. If you look in, Mintz's book, Jerome Mintz's book, a wonderful book called Hasidic People, he has a whole story there about Chich in contemporary Satmar and how it played out during the disputes over the Satmar Rav. Okay, let's now return to Rabbi Zevin. We stopped last class and I was talking about his most lasting and enduring work, really, Hamoedim B'Halacha, which I said, with the exception of Shmir Shabbos Kelchasa, is the most popular sefer, halacha sefer, printed in modern times. But his most significant achievement, he didn't do it himself entirely, but he was very involved in it, I think would have to be the Talmudic Encyclopedia. He was head of the Talmudic Encyclopedia, head of its editorial head, from 1942 until his death. This is an unbelievable work, which they only translated a few volumes into English. I think they realize that there's no need to translate into English. It's not that sort of work. Never before in Jewish history had a work like the Talmudic Encyclopedia appeared. The originator of this project was Rav Meir Bar Ilan, the important Mizrahi figure, and he saw this as part of the Zionist vision, return to the land of Israel, and every good society needs an encyclopedia, and a Torah society needs a Torah encyclopedia. It was he who got Rav Zevin on board. You need a special type of rabbi in Talmud Chacham to you can't ask a typical Gadol Yisrael, you can't ask a Rav Moshe Feinstein, someone like that. You need a different type of person. The vision of an encyclopedia, by the way, was first expressed by Rav Kook, who spoke not of a Likut, a gathering of Acharonim, but a real encyclopedia. Now, Bar Ilan, Rav Meir Bar Ilan, he wanted an encyclopedia geared towards the masses, sort of like a Britannica in English. Rav Zevin wanted an encyclopedia geared towards Torah scholars. And if if you're wireless, that could be the reason. Rav Zevin wanted an encyclopedia geared toward Torah scholars. And his position carried the day. Now, there were a number of Talmidei Chachamim involved with the project. If you have any of the volumes, open up to the second page there, and you'll see a list of them. One of the Talmidei Chachamim from years ago actually was Rav David Cohen of Flatbush. He wrote a long, it was too long, they couldn't include it, Kuntres on Hashmal, on electricity, which was... It only came out, I think, last year or the year before as a separate volume. But the Tzitz Eliezer was involved and many, many others, important figures. The first volume appears in 1947, and as I mentioned, Rav Zevin was the coordinator from its beginning until his death. So let me tell you, though, what's special about the Talmudic Encyclopedia. Now, some of you might be thinking there were Talmudic Encyclopedias in the past. What I said is incorrect. And there were quasi-encyclopedias in the past. There was a great rabbi. If any of you want to come to Italy with me this summer, we'll see his house. We'll talk a lot about him. When we go visit Ferrara, it was on our trip last year. I was all set. Lots of pages of notes and things I want to tell you. Copies of important works from there. However, there was an earthquake, if you recall, in the spring, and the synagogue was damaged. So no trip to Ferrara last year. We'll go this coming year. I'll also speak about the writings of George Bassani, if you know his important works, and a lot to discuss. Well, Isaac Lampronti, in the 18th century, wrote a work called the Pachad Yitzchak. Not Rav Huttner's Pachad Yitzchak, this isn't the first Pachad Yitzchak, which is always described as the Talmudic Encyclopedia. You can find it in HebrewBooks.org. It's many, many volumes. Yet if you look at it, you will see that it's not really an encyclopedia. He doesn't discuss the topics the way an encyclopedia will. He has many categories. For most of the categories, all he does is give references to various achronim. In some of the categories, there's original tshuvot of him and of others, very interesting material, very important for the study of Italy, but it's mostly just cross-references, and it's not an encyclopedia. Some of you might be thinking of the Sedei Chemed, of Rav Chaim Chizkiyahu Medini, who ends the last years of his life, is spent in Hebron. But that too, although it's more of an encyclopedia, it's not really an encyclopedia. Take a look at it. It has categories, but it really is a collection of comments of Rishonim and Nachronim on different topics. It's a great resource, not an encyclopedia. Now, SH tells me the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir is now the editor of which Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir. I'm not sure which Rosh Yeshiva, so you'll have to tell me. Take a look at the Sedei Chemed. You'll see that basically on each theme, he'll quote a lot of Rishonim and Achronim, but it's not an encyclopedia the way we think of it, where you start with different categories and you work from early to late, just like any other encyclopedia. Oh, thank you, Rabbi Shmuelitz. And the Talmudic Encyclopedia is a work, like the Britannica, a comprehensive reference work. Now, it is true that today there's no need for encyclopedias like Britannica. If you want to purchase the last edition of the Britannica, you can buy it now. They will not be publishing anymore. The Encyclopedia Judaica came out with one. I can't imagine there'll be any more. Today, with the Internet, truthfully, Wikipedia has everything you need. However, there is no equivalent Wikipedia or anything online for the Talmudic Encyclopedia. It could be that one day the encyclopedia will be obsolete. However, it is not obsolete now, and it's still appearing. And Bill tells us that Rav Zalman Nachemet Goldberg is the editor, and you have other people on the board. The assistant, and then he really took over, was a man by the name of Rav Huttner. Not Rav Yitzhak Huttner, Rav Yeshua Huttner. They're cousins, and Rav Yeshua Huttner was the brother-in-law of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, and he was involved with Rav Zevin for decades. And years later, he wrote about how before the appearance of the first volume, there was a discussion, what do you call this new work they're going to put out? There were some people who didn't like the name encyclopedia, because they said it's not a Hebrew term. They suggested terms like Kolbo, the Otsar, Sefer Arachim. Others, however, said that if we use the name Sanhedrin, which is a Greek word, then why not use the word encyclopedia? Now, with Sanhedrin, there is a Hebrew term based in Haggadah, and yet we still use the Greek term. That's an interesting question, by the way. Why did the term Sanhedrin stick and not based in Haggadah? Rabbi Yeshua Huttner, who himself, by the way, was a very fine Talmud Chacham. I have a number of letters from Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg to him. I published some of them. Rabbi Huttner suggests that the reason we use the term Sanhedrin, not Beit in Agado, I mean, just think of it. It's a little strange here. Most of us don't use the term Pentateuch. We use the term Chumash. Most of us don't use Greek terms when there's a Hebrew term. So why use Sanhedrin? Not based on Agado. Now, granted, the tractate is called Sanhedrin, but that just begs the question, why? Why is it called Sanhedrin? Rabbi Huttner thinks because the Sanhedrin was more than a Beitin. It was a supreme religious authority, and that's why people didn't want to use a term like Beitin, even based on Agado, because it has the connotation of ruling in various cases, and the Sanhedrin was really more than that. By the way, since I mentioned Ferrara, I'll tell you that in the middle of the 16th century, the Jews of Ferrara established a literary society, and they called it by the name Academia. Now, some Kanaim, some zealots, even in Italy you had zealots, they objected to the application of this pagan name to a Jewish body, But Rabbi Zaya DeRossi, who tells the story, claims that he was able to quiet everyone by pointing out that the term, the Greek term academia, actually is derived from a Hebrew, the Hebrew words eked, collection, and adam, man. So it's academia, collection of men. So academia, collection of men. Of course, this is a nonsensical derivation, but that's what the Zaya DeRossi said. There was also a similar objection when the Academy of the Hebrew Language, Academia of the Lashon Ivrit, was established in Jerusalem in 1973. There were also people who protested and said that you should not have a Greek term like this. Instead, you should have a Hebrew term. Let me go on with Rav Zevin, some of his other important writings. He was the first one to write reviews of Torah literature, of Torah, and these were later collected in three volumes of his work, Sofrim Usfarim. Pretty much everything of significance, every book of significance that appeared between the years 1936 and 1946 was reviewed by him, mostly in HaTzofeh. Other than Rav Zevin, we do not have another volume like this, in which the author reviews books of Chidushim and Responsa, pointing out what's significant about the works, adding notes, criticisms. In the rabbinic world, you don't even have criticisms, book reviews. It's not part of the culture. So, and these works are very significant. His next work, which is my favorite, is Ishim B'Shitot. Been reprinted a few times. Never published in English. I have no idea why Artscroll translated the Hamodim Ha'acha. It translated his Treasury of Hasidic Tales. Another work that Rav Zevin wrote is a Treasury of Hasidic Tales. In the introduction of his grandson to this book, Ishim B'Shitot, they say that some Talmidei Chachamim told him he shouldn't do this work. You know, this is a work that worked on the, based on the Parsha. And on each Parsha, he records various Hasidic tales that have some sort of connection, even tangential to the Parsha. It's a great book. If you want a Vort, granted it's a Hasidic Vort, but if you want a Vort, this is the way place to go. When Art School translated into English, it's very popular. Rav Zevin obviously did not feel that it was demeaning to him to repeat Hasidic tales. He himself is a Hasid. But Art School, and I can't explain why, they never translated Ishim B'Shitos, which translates to be men and their views, their ideologies, their perspectives. In Hebrew, everyone tells you when you're learning Hebrew that the plural of ish is anashim. It's actually not true. Anashim is the plural of the word anash, aleph nun shin. We've been accustomed to use the word anashim as a plural of ish, even though it is not the plural of ish, and anashim and ishim are different. Ishim, the word, when you use the word ishim, you're signifying the significance of the individual. Anashim is a group of people. Ishim are a group of individuals. So it has a different meaning. Someone was writing something? No. Why is this book so significant? First of all, the topic is so interesting. To write about the Shitot, the outlook of the various great rabbis. Second of all, he shows a keen ability to not just appreciate, but to analyze the Torah writings of great sages. I have to say that the chapters are a bit uneven, because the book is written at different times for different purposes. Let me just read you the table of contents, but not all, some of the chapters are classic. Chapter on the Rugged Shavar, chapter on Reb Chaim Soloveitchik is unbelievable, and I'm going to give you some examples. Some of the other chapters are really not, they're sort of like book, lengthy book reviews that have been included. He has a chapter on Rav Kook, on Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein. So, I mean, these are great Torah sages, and he tells you some of their chidushim, but you don't get the originality, the greatness of the description is not the same. He has the Netziv here, Rav Meir Simcha, Rav Chaim Moser, Grzinski, Rav Baruch Bar Leibovitz, the Chazon Ish, Rav Zalman Meltzer. But it's Rav Chaim. some of the things he says about replying, that chapter itself should be translated. Some of the things he says about replying have become classic. And everyone in yeshivas knows them because of what he says. SH says, Dafka, because it's my favorite book, they did not want the headache sure to follow. But that is an assumption that often will be correct. I grant you that. But in this case, I don't think so, because I don't see anything that would cause trouble for the hagiographers in this book. It wouldn't be the easiest work to translate because he deals with Moshe Mordechai Epstein. He deals with, his halachic writings and together with all the other sages. But they did this in Hamoadim B'Halacha. They did an excellent job in taking the halachic argumentation and putting it into English. So I don't know. In any event, the chapter on Rechaim is brilliant. After reading it, this is why I think the chapters aren't even. After reading the chapter on Rechaim, you get a real sense of who he was, what made him so significant. You get a sense of the power of his personality and his brilliance and his halach and his Talmudic achievement. And he doesn't just give examples of his method of learning. He does that as well. He also, as I said, records amazing stories which have now become famous precisely because he recorded them. I want to give you some of these stories, say a bit on them. One of the stories actually is rejected by the family. I'll talk about that in a minute. But let me just tell you quickly some of the stories. I'm sure most of you, or some of you at least, have heard of some of the stories. But let me go over them and add a few points. This is one of the great ones. He's telling a story that he heard from Rav Yecheskel Abramsky. Rav Yecheskel Abramsky, we'll do classes on Rav Yecheskel Abramsky, the great Rav of Slutsk, spends time in Soviet prison, then rabbi in London, goes to Israel. He was rabbi in communist Russia as well. He was once in Rav Chaim's house. People would go visit Rav Chaim. He was among them. And there was another rabbi with him, and a Jew comes in to Rav Chaim. He complains about the Chevra Kadisha. What's the problem? Two men died in Brisk on the same day. One of them was the relative of this man who came to complain about the Chevra Kadisha. And he said, the man was saying that according to the Jewish law, you have to bury the one who dies first. And yet the Gaboim, the people involved in the Chevra Kadisha, because the second person who died was rich and respected, they buried him first. And this man is coming in, he wants justice, he wants the Chevra Kadisha, the Gaboim, to be rebuked by Rav Chaim that they violated halacha, that just because he's not from a rich family, his relative died first, needed to be buried first. Rav Chaim listened to his complaint, took out of the bookcase a Rambam, opened it up to Hilchos Avel. Most people say that this word should be pronounced Hilchos Avel, with Seire under the Aleph, but some people say it should be pronounced Hilchot Avel. Avel. That would be a Kamatz, I guess, under the Aleph. I can't say which is right. Maybe they're both right. He opened it up, and he opened it up to Hilchos Avel. He looked there, he put the book away, and he said to the complainer, I will rebuke the Gaboim, but this has nothing to do with you, and sent the man on his way. Rav Zevin records that the rabbis there, there's Rav Yecheskel Abramsky and the other rabbi, were in wonder for two reasons. First of all, they knew the Rambam as well. It says that they picked up the Rambam, I guess after a Chaim looked at it, and they looked in Hilchos Avel, and they didn't find anything in the entire Rambam that declares who's buried first. So where does Rav Chaim get his answer from the Rambam? Second of all, what's this business that this has nothing to do with you? He says, Mimanash Shacha. Mamanash Shacha, as we say in Yiddish. If the man is correct, and the Gavayim of the Chevra Kadisha were wrong, and that they need to be rebuked because they buried the wrong person first, then of course it has something to do with him. He's the relative of the dead person. So how could the Reb Chaim say to him, it has nothing to do with you? Reb Chaim replies to them, when the man came to me, he says, and explained his complaint, I wasn't sure about this din. You know, the din, what's the basis of the din? Reb Chaim says that you have to bury the one who dies first. Is this a din, a general din, of ein ma'avir in ala mitzvos? We know we have this principle that you don't pass over a mitzvah. You have a mitzvah, you do this mitzvah first. Or was this a special din in burial, in kvuras hameis, that there's a special din that you have to bury the first one who died first? From the simple way of looking at it, it would appear that, what's the difference? Either way, you have to bury the first person who died first, either because of ein ma'avir in ala mitzvah or because of a special din of kvura. But of course, if you're Reb Chaim, nothing is simple, and there is a nafkamina. So Reb Chaim says, I looked in the Rambam, and he does not bring down in Hilchos Avel this law. He doesn't mention anything in Hilchos Avel who has to be buried first. Siman she'ein atam mishum kavod amei. This is a proof that the idea that you bury the mate, the first one who dies first, it has nothing, it's not a special din in kavod amei. Because if it was a special din in kavod amei, it'd be a special din in the Rambam. Rather, this is a din in all mitzvos. And its basis is ein ma'avir in ala mitzvos, that we don't put aside this mitzvah for another mitzvah. Therefore, you don't find it in Hilchos Avel. In other words, this is Reb Chaim, this is what's so brilliant. Therefore, Haresh HaGabaim lo pagu b'chvod haniftar. Therefore, the Gabais were not pogeya. They didn't do anything negative. They didn't hurt the honor of the dead person. Because there's no special din in Kavod Hameis about burying. Rather, Stam Avru Al Din, they simply violated Halacha. Uvachain. And therefore, because I am the Rav, the responsibility is on me to rebuke the Gabaim. Aval Mazeh Nogeh LaIsh. But what does this have to do with the man? In other words, it has nothing to do with a separate din about mitzvos, like any other mitzvah, like Hanukkah candles or anything else, and therefore I have to rebuke the Gabaim. But this man can't feel offended, he can't feel like his relative was treated with a lack of kavod, because it has nothing to do with his relative, it has nothing to do with kavod ames. It's not specific to kavod ames. And here we have an example of where Reb Chaim, this is Reb Zevin, points out, he learns this halakha from what is not written. Precisely because it's not written, he derives it. So this is a famous story. Another story. In the new edition, this is on page 51. And this is the one that I'll tell you is a bit of controversial. Although I really don't see why it should be. It might be not factual, but I don't see the controversy. Reb Chaim asked this question. Why, after talking about the greatness of Reb Chaim, why did Reb Chaim not decide questions of Jewish law? Let me tell you something about Reb Chaim. I know you're going to find this hard to believe, but it's true. I even had a discussion of this with, I know Bill is an old YU guy. I don't know, Bill, you remember Rabbi Golevsky from YU? Rabbi Chaim Dovber Golevsky, he taught that he was never a Rosh Yeshiva, although he's a big Talmud Chacham now. Publisher of Sfarim, he taught in TI, I believe, the Teachers Institute. He is a grandson of Rav Simcha Zelig Rieger of Risk, and I had two very long conversations with him. He's well into his 90s now. As far as I know, there's only two people alive, two rabbinic figures born in Risk, two people who could talk about the Torah world of Risk. One is Rav Aaron Leif Steinman, who is really number one or number two, it depends who you ask, I guess. I shouldn't say that. He's number one or number two in one part of the Haredi world, either him or Chaim Kanievsky, but the Haredi world is very split now. There's another, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's son is a real Kanai, very different than his father, and he's been attacking Rabbi Steinman, and there's been all sorts of anonymous stuff coming out attacking Rabbi Steinman, who himself is very much on the right. He's not a liberal in the Haredi terms at all, but they don't think he's extreme enough. But Rav Steinman is born in Brisk. So is Rabbi Goletsky, born in Brisk. And I got some great stories from Rabbi Goletsky. And what I'm going to tell you now comes directly from him, although I've seen it in other places as well, but confirmed from him. Rav Chaim, we know Rav Chaim, first of all, didn't paskin. There were dayanim in the city. The most famous dayan is Rav Simcha Zelig Rieger. That's the grandfather of Rabbi Goletsky, also, and the great-grandfather, by the way, of Professor Sarah, I don't know how she pronounces her name, Rieger of Brooklyn College, but that is the name Rieger, Simcha Zelig, the dayan of Brisk. I can show you a picture of him, by the way. He did not dress in rabbinic garb, just like Rav Chaim didn't dress in rabbinic garb. So he's the dayan. But not only that, Rav Chaim never spoke, he never gave a shiur to the community. Think of what our rabbis do today. They passed in shilas, Rav Chaim didn't. Rav Chaim didn't give shiurim to the masses, like rabbis do today. There were other people who gave shiurim, yet shiurim on Ein Yaakov, on Mishnah. So Rav Chaim doesn't give shiurim. Rav Chaim never spoke. He never gave a drasha. He never even spoke and by the way, Rav Elva was the same. He never spoke on even Shabbos Shuv or Shabbos Hagadol. So what's going on here? What kind of community pays a rabbi? He doesn't decide halakha questions. He doesn't give shiurim. He doesn't ever give a drasha, speak to the community. What kind of rabbi is that? But that's Rav Chaim. And why would a community therefore want a rabbi like this? Well, first of all, from the standpoint of the community, this is the greatest kavod in the world, to have someone who's a genius, who's a great Torah scholar, to have such a person supported by the community. And they have a magid to give drashas, and you have a dayan to teach, and you have another guy to give shiurim. The community in those days took honor in having the rav. By the way, most rabbis didn't give drashas anyway, although most would paskin. This is quite unusual. And if you eat Reb Chaim, when he explained what the job, if you want to know what Reb Chaim did, it isn't that he just sat and learned. Although for some communities that would be fine for the rabbi to sit and learn. Reb Chaim, when asked what the most important thing, or explaining what the most important thing to the rabbi was, he said it's to take care of the widows and orphans. In other words, Reb Chaim was a social worker. Reb Chaim looked out and took care of his community. He didn't need to be involved in posting shaylas. There was someone to do that or giving drushas. He took care of the individuals in the community. So it's interesting to think our own rabbis today, how they compare in that. Why did the Eivel compare to him? Because he's the Rav of the community. The Eivel wasn't coming to ask a halacha question. The Eivel knew what the halacha was, that you have to bury the first one who died first. The Eivel was coming to him to get justice. Because Rav Chaim is the Rav, and Rav Chaim is going to set things right. If a girl would get pregnant, let's say, out of wedlock, the baby would be given to Rav Chaim. He'd find a place for it. If someone didn't have a home, his home burnt down, Rav Chaim would take care of it and find a place for them. And when the Eivel comes to Rav Chaim knew what the halacha was. He just didn't know why the halacha was this way. Was it halacha in Kavod HaMeis or in Ein Mavir Ela HaMeis? And that's why he had to look in the Rambam. That's why he came to the Meis. That's why he came to the Eivel, came to him. So Rav Zevin, though, asked the question. So why didn't Rav Chaim paskin, though? Rav Chaim knew halacha. He knew Shas. He knew Rambam. He knew Shulchan Aruch. He knew all of this. Who ever heard of a Rav that doesn't paskin? Not giving drushas. That we have plenty of other examples of rabbis. Some rabbis, at the most, they give a drusha Shabbos HaGadol and Shabbos Shuvah. But and he would never, no Rav. It's almost unheard of for the rabbi to give classes for the masses, Talmud classes or anything like that. But every Rav would paskin shilas. Yes, in big cities like Vilna and Warsaw, you had Dayanim as well. But if you had a big city that actually had an official Rav, they would paskin. Chaim Moshe Grzinski paskin shilas. Every day he paskin shilas. So what is it about Rav Chaim that he didn't paskin shilas? He needed a dayan. He brought in Rav Simcha Zelig to be the dayan to paskin shilas. There's a special kollel in Vilna for practical rabbinics, I guess you could say. Rav Zevin asks that question and he says as follows. There are some who think that the reason is because he was miyirei hara. He's one of these figures that doesn't want to take the responsibility on his shoulders. Yarei mahachrayut. Rav Zevin says there are some who say that. I don't know anyone who actually says that. I guess there were some people, because anyone who knows about Reb Chaim knows that he was not afraid of taking responsibility. We're going to see some examples where he took on all the other great rabbis. So that he wasn't, but Sir Reb Zevin raised the question. Reb Zevin says, in my opinion, he's telling you he doesn't know this for a fact. He's never heard this from anyone else, but he says, in my opinion, and his opinion as one who's in this world and knows things very well, by the way, Rav Velvo of Soloveitchik loved this chapter. Although we're going to see he disagreed with this point. Rav Velvo loved this chapter on his father. Rav Zevin says the reason was different. Rav Chaim, and I'm just translating here, Rav Chaim felt that he could not go in the royal path. You know, he couldn't follow convention. If he were to decide halacha, he would be obligated to paskin against the ragil, the hamakubal. He'd be obligated to decide against the convention, against even the Shulchan Aruch, against what people do. Whenever his clear mind told him that this is what halacha is, different than what the Gedolei Poskim said. Rav Zevin says that the pure conscience of this man of truth, would not permit him to be mevato his opinion. But yet, if he was going to paskin halacha, he would have to be Mevatel's opinion because he has a sense of responsibility that he can't totally upend, you know, standard halacha. And as a proof for this, he brings a story that Rav Meir Bar Ilan told. It's found, Rav Meir Bar Ilan wrote a book, which also should be translated to English, From Volozhin to Jerusalem. He originally published in Yiddish and then translated to Hebrew. That there was a dayan, a special dayan whose job it was gittin in Brisk. His name was Refival. And he prepared a get, and another dayan questioned this get. We don't know who this other dayan is. And they came to Reb Chaim asking him, and Reb Chaim said that each one of the dayanim should give him their reasons why the get is pasul or kosher in writing. And he, after receiving this, sent their opinions to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan in Kovno. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan is the next figure we're going to deal with, the great posek of his day. So we're talking the late 19th century. And Reb Chaim included there a letter saying that Rav Yitzchak Elchanan should reply to him in a telegraph, or in a short letter, just give the reason that the get is kosher, or the get is pasul, no reasons whatsoever. This is the story of Rav Meir Bar Ilan tells, and he explains that those who are close to Reb Chaim, they knew, Reb Chaim explained that, in his letter to Rabbi Zalchanan, he doesn't want to trouble him. Rabbi Zalchanan is asked all over the world, they're asking him shaylos. He doesn't want to trouble him with the reasons. Just tell me the answer. But those who are close to Reb Chaim, and Reb Meir Bar Ilan he's mishpacha with Reb Chaim. Reb Meir Bar Ilan is the son of the Netziv. Reb Chaim marries the granddaughter of the Netziv. So although Reb Chaim is older than Reb Meir Bar Ilan, that would make Reb Meir Bar Ilan I don't even know what the relationship would be. I can't figure it out while I'm talking so fast. First cousin once removed or something like that. But the Netziv, I think he's 70 years old, right, when Rav Meir Bar Ilan is born. Rav Chaim Bar Ilan is some 50-something years older than his brother. But the reason Rav Meir Bar Ilan says is that, one more thing. Rav Meir Bar Ilan, despite being a big religious Zionist, was always treated with respect by Rav Velvo, once Rav Meir Bar Ilan left Rav Velvo, and Rav Velvo always had kanaim. Great, his uncle, thank you. Rav Velvo always had these crazies around him, kanaim. We spoke about this in the past, how Rav Arye Levine told Ritzi Yehuda Kripa. Ritzi Yehuda used to go to shiurim with Rav Velvo, but he would be abused by the kanaim there. You know, they'd make fun of his father and say things. Rav Arye Levine told him that it's forbidden for you to go there because you know, they're going to make fun of, they're going to mock and attack your father. So we know that there were always a lot of zealots there. And now why did I say that? So the story is we have it recorded that Rameir Bar Ilan, once he left Rav Velbal, and one of the Kanaim said, why do you give him such kavod? And Rav Velbal replied something that's famous for briskers and very important, that he's mishpacha. And if you know about briskers, nothing is more important than family, and the fact that Rav Meir Bar Ilan is now a tzioni, it doesn't matter, he's family. So Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan explains that those who are close to Rav Chaim knew that the reason was not because didn't want Rav Yitzchak Hanan to trouble himself, the long responds him. But if he said that if Rav Chaim were to give a tshuva with his reasons, it's possible that Rav Chaim would not accept the reasons. And therefore Rav Chaim would feel, let's say he sends back a letter, and Rav Chaim assumed that the get was kosher. I think that's the assumption of the story. If Rav Yitzchak Hanan sends back saying it's kosher, but gives reasons, but yet Rav Chaim doesn't like the reasons. Well, let me take that back. I don't know if Rav Chaim assumed that it's kosher. But if Rav Yitzchak Hanan sends back saying it's kosher, we're saying it's not kosher. And he gives the reasons, and Rav Chaim doesn't like the reasons, because Rav Chaim has a different way of thinking Talmudically. He would have a real question, can he rely on Rav Yitzchak Hanan's psak? I mean, if Rav Yitzchak Hanan gives a psak, but Rav Chaim thinks that the reason is bogus, maybe he can't rely on it. However, if Rav Yitzchak Hanan just sends him yes or no answer, Rav Yitzchak Hanan is important enough and significant enough that you can be somech, you can rely on his ruling. He's enough of an important thing, you can rely on it without knowing the reason. But if you know the reason, then all of a sudden you have a problem, because if he doesn't agree with it, then what to do? And that's a problem for Rav Chaim, because Rav Chaim doesn't want a paskin, he just wants the answer. Now this is the story, this is the famous story, it's told by many people, I believe, I could be mistaken, but I think Rabbi Soloveitchik even told the story, although he might have got it from Rabbi Zevin. The only problem is that we have another book. It's called Halichot Hagrach, which is it's taking opinions of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik throughout the Shulchan Aruch. The problem with this book is that this book engages in a good deal of plagiarism, much of it from Rav Schechter's book Nefesh HaRav. They cite, whenever they quote something from Nefesh HaRav, I forget the formula they use, Mipi Talmidim, or Talmidei Talmidim, something like that, or Mipi HaShmua, something like that. But it's taken, so it's a book of plagiarism. But in this case, they cite something from, one of the students of Rabbeinu Soloveitchik, who's the son of Rav Velbal. And I saw the same idea recorded in this book, which really is an official brisk book. Uldos van Hagos Lebeit Brisk. I couldn't find the place where it's here, but from what I remember, it's in here as well, where they say that, that's not the reason. This case. Remember, Meir Bar Ilan told you about the story. And then he says, but the reason why he didn't rely on the Rav Yitzchak Hanan, why he just asked for the psak, and he gives the reason. In the family, apparently, there's another tradition as to why he didn't rely. He just wanted the one word answer. And that's, they explain, because Rav Chaim didn't want to get into a debate with this Dayan. Apparently the Dayan, who apostle to get, was very stubborn. And he knew that if reasons were given, this Dayan would have his own way of slugging up the reasons, just like he didn't accept the reasons of the Dayan who muttered the get. And therefore, he made an agreement with them that they'll accept the Rav Yitzchak Hanan, and lo and behold, he only asked Rav Yitzchak Hanan for a short answer. Therefore, this Dayan wouldn't be able to argue, because, as I said, if Rav Yitzchak Hanan wrote a tshuva, this Dayan was such a stubborn Dayan, he'd start to spoon Rav Yitzchak Hanan as well. Now, I can't say, obviously, what is true and what's not, but I don't see the story as a crazy story. You know, the reason that is given by Rav Meir Bar Ilan, because I found in this official Brisker book here, Udos Van Hagos, We Break Risk, that they quote in here of Baruch Ber Leibovitz, who was like a Talmud Muvhak of the Chaim Soloveitchik, and it's not from this different story. I'll get you that other one in a minute. Reb Chaim Zimmerman quotes as follows, that there was a butcher in Brisk, and one evening he comes to Reb Chaim with a question about a chicken, and Reb Chaim sent for Reb Simcha Zelig, because Reb Chaim doesn't answer questions like this, and Reb Simcha Zelig permitted the chicken, and he told Reb Chaim why he permitted it. Reb Chaim attempted to refute his arguments, and a big dispute opened between them. You know, it went on all night. And after a while, you know, the questioner asked Reb Chaim that, you know, I have to go back home. You know, I need an answer. Is it kosher or not? And then Reb Chaim turned to Reb Simcha Zelig and said to him, I now want you to decide the halacha, but not give the reason. And then Reb Simcha Zelig koshered the chicken, and the man went on his way. So here you have an example of where Reb Chaim, as long as Reb Simcha Zelig gave the reason, Reb Chaim didn't accept the reason and was arguing with it. But when it came to actual decide the halacha, yes or no answer, then Reb Chaim said, okay, I can rely on you, Reb Simcha Zelig. I think your reasons are all wrong, but you're enough of a person. Just give me the reason. I don't know if this is common that they argued. Apparently they agreed on everything. One of the great stories that Rav Schechter tells, he repeats the story from Rav Soloveitchik, is that when Rav Soloveitchik was young, Rav Soloveitchik only saw his grandfather a few times, two or three times. It's not like he lived in Brisk or anything, not at all. But when he was young, he traveled more than two, maybe three or four. He traveled once to Brisk, and it was Shabbos that Joseph Baer, young Joseph Dov, has a toothache, tooth problem or a mouth problem. I forget now which one, a tooth or a mouth. I think it's a tooth. They call for a doctor, and a doctor's looking in his mouth, and the doctor can't see much. You know, it's getting dark. It's dark in the room, and he says, I could use a little bit of light. He didn't even say turn on the light. He said, I could use some more light. And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was there. Moshe Soloveitchik, hardly an ignoramus. And Rav Chaim looks at Rav Moshe, you know, turn the light on and raise, it wouldn't be a light, it would be raise the candles or move the candle over, whatever you need to do. It's probably to move the candle closer, although you can check, I forget the details. And Rav Moshe hesitates, you know, it's Chilul Shabbos. Rav Chaim looks to Rav Simcha Zelig and says, Simcha Zelig, you go do it. You know, don't worry. You know, he's not Maritz. So, I just think it's a great story. Ira Griska, both reasons are compatible. Yeah, both reasons are compatible, but, according to the first story, it's Rav Chaim himself was afraid. And if he gave him a reason, Reb Chaim would not be able to accept it because he'd find problems, and therefore he just wants the answer. According to the second one, it's the stubborn Dayan. It's a much nicer story, the first one, though, because it shows, and it really fits in so much with what we know about Reb Chaim, that he really couldn't be involved in Prat Halacha because he would always see different sides to every case, and he never could have a yes or no answer. It always was... And when he did get a yes or no answer, it's a really different perspective. I'm going to give you some of the stories. He comes up with ideas, and Rezevin quotes some of them, that no one ever has thought of these things. But after he explains them, and everything then seems so clear, it makes so much sense. I hope to do classes on Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. Rezevin does a good job also in showing that, you know, when it's Reb Chaim and the Rambam and the Raivad, it's no longer about defending the Rambam against the Raivad. It's about explaining the system of the Rambam and the system of the Raiva. And it's not about one being right and one being wrong. It's a completely different approach. Ira says that he could have been motivated by both of these points. You're right, he could have been. The difference is, though, in this book, Roberto Soloveitchik, the son of Yitzhak Zev says that this is false. Sheker. V'chazav, he says it's nonsense that this what's recorded by Rav Meir Bar Ilan. So I can't say, and I would tend to think that Rav Elbel knows more, but we're talking about something that happened. Rav Meir Bar Ilan was older than Rav Elbel. Rav Meir Bar Ilan knew Rav Chaim from Volozhin. We're talking about an event that would have occurred before Rav Elbel was even alive, I'm assuming, or Rav Elbel was just very, very young. So I'm not sure who you give more authority to in a case like that. There's about three or four other of these famous stories that Rav Chaim, that Rav Zevin made famous. I will get to them next class. I see it's already time. Some great stuff. But let me see if there's any questions here. Let's see. No, I could go on. I could go on for a long time, but it's already 10 o'clock. I don't know if any of you know the story about the guy who forgot Atachon Antanu. And so when you make up, he forgot Shemona Esrei, Ma'ariv of Motzei Shabbos. So when you make it up, what goes first? That's one of the stories I'll discuss. Just to whet your appetite, I'm discussing the story about Reb Chaim and the missionary, which David Berger loves that story. Reb Chaim and being Machmir on Yom Kippur, being Mekel on Yom Kippur versus Machmir on Dinei Nefashos, where Rav Zevin quotes Rav Elbel Soloveitchik as giving the reason for this. So there's some, these are just some of the stories I'll get to next class. I said I have four or five more stories. And then we will move on to discuss different aspects of his writing. And one of the things I'll focus on next class, we'll end Rav Zevin next class, is The Merchant of Venice. Any other great Torah sage? Is there any other one who could have written an article about the Merchant of Venice in Halakha? Another essay which just cries to be translated into English. Shylock in Halakha. Can, if I make a contract to get my pound of flesh, is that a valid contract or not? And don't quickly answer and say, of course not, we can't... I can't take someone, if I tell you that I want to give you a present, I'm going to cut off a piece of skin, who says I can't do that, if it's my skin? We have to investigate. So we'll get to that next class. Yes, Rabbi Bleich. And Rabbi Bleich, you're right, Rabbi Bleich could write such an article. Rabbi Bleich is, he's not that sort of model. Rabbi Bleich is a PhD, he's a college graduate. I'd expect him to know this, but your typical great Torah sage, I wonder, did Rav Moshe Feinstein, I don't know about Rav Moshe, I'm not sure, I can pretty much guarantee that Rav Vadi Yosef, if it wasn't for Rav Zevin's work, never heard of Merchant of Venice. I pretty much guarantee that the Stipor never heard of the Merchant of Venice, never heard of Shylock. Maybe they heard of Shakespeare, maybe not. Who can say? I'll tell you an interesting story about the Satmar next week and Al Pacino. And Merchant of Venice. You know, at least most of us in New York know that Al Pacino played the Merchant of Venice. And I'll tell you how about the Satmar. They know Al Pacino. They didn't know who Shakespeare was. We'll get to that next class. Yes, Rav Lichtenstein. Okay. You're talking about and Rav Nachum Rabinovitz. I can give you many examples, people, but of the old school, Gedolei Yisrael of the old school, who never had college educations, who never really... Last things before I go, he ate Rav Simcha Zelig's white matzot. Okay, that story I don't know. I hear you, Ira. So, Ira, I met your daughter, by the way, two Shabbos ago when I was scholar in residence. That was very nice to meet her, and I hope she sent regards from me to you, because she said very nice things about me from you, so that was nice. And I was happy to see some of you at in Edison. We had a very nice turnout, a nice crowd. They do wonderful things. Mel's here in Edison. Saturday night, community gets together. We had people who came up even from Lakewood, from New York. So that was very nice. Okay. I don't know if SH is Shlomo. I think it is. Shlomo, you were there too. So Everyone, I hope those who celebrate Thanksgiving have a very nice Thanksgiving. Those who don't, enjoy. At least I hope your minion Thursday morning is a little bit later. Our minion is 8:15 instead of 6 a.m. or 5:50 on Thursday morning. So enjoy that, and we'll see you all, God willing, next Monday night. Good night, everyone.